The next Poetry Center reading will be 2 weeks from tonight. That will be the Contest Awards reading, April 21st, in the Student Union Terrace Lounge. We figured we didn't have enough poetry readings this semester, so we've added one more. We're going to have a new book celebration on the 25th of April. That will be a Sunday afternoon. We'll be sending out a notice on that to honor 8 recent books of poetry by residents of the area. And Raleigh Kent will be reading at Pima College on Thursday, April 22nd, West Campus. The last Writers at Work will be next Tuesday night, April 13th. The readers are N. Scott Momaday and Todd Lieber. And that reading will be in the new Harville Auditorium. The Harville building is the new classroom building on 2nd and Olive. We're preparing the last newsletter of the year. We'll take items for the newsletter until Friday this week. We publish only good news. Leslie Allman's first collection of poems, Natural Histories, won the 1978 Yale Series of Younger Poets Award. Her poems have appeared in such magazines as The New Yorker, The Nation, Shenandoah, Mademoiselle, Poetry Northwest, and many others. In addition to the Yale Prize, she's been a recipient of National Endowment for the Arts grant. She's currently teaching at the University of Texas in El Paso. I had the pleasure to hear her read 2 years ago. She's a very fine reader, fine lady. I hope you'll be able to come to the Poetry Center following the reading to have some refreshments and meet Leslie Allman.
Thank you. I've sort of fallen in love with your campus after jogging through it today. I can't imagine why anybody would write when they can just walk around and eat salad bars and things. It's sort of paradise. I, first of all, want you to let me know if you'd like to hear anything a second time, especially the poems in Natural History seem to need to be read more than once. And I feel a little hesitant about just doing them all, but if anybody would like to hear one again, please just wave a hand. I think I'll start with some from Natural Histories and then move to some new things and then come back to Natural Histories. And if there's anything you want to hear, just yell at me. I really don't mind it. Just let me know what you want. Since a lot of you are writers, and since I'm also more comfortable doing this, I think I'd like to tell you a little bit about why I wanted to write each poem. I can't explain the poem, obviously, but I enjoy saying why the poem wanted to get started at all. And sometimes what you'll hear will be a distant outgrowth from what I wanted. And other times you might see a relationship. I don't particularly care what you see. I just want to share that process because it continues to be a mystery to me. And since we're all involved in the same, trying to navigate from the point of wanting to write a poem to actually allowing oneself to finish it, I'd like to just share as much of that process as I can. The first few, I guess a lot of these poems in the book were written, I felt at the time they were written from someone else's point of view, because I think in the beginning I felt much more comfortable not being myself. I didn't think I had anything to say. It's a fear we never get over, but I think as we get older and more pompous, we think get away with it. And I am starting to write from my own point of view, for better or for worse. But in the beginning, I didn't, and I found it kind of exciting. I still am excited by the idea. I found I could see more clearly when I got into someone else's skin, and that I was drawing on experience that I hadn't had firsthand, but I had had somewhere through looking at movies or reading books or just having very intense conversations over years of being alive, that I found I absorbed a lot more vicarious experience than I realized. So in the beginning, in an incidental way, poetry helped me get access to those different voices, those different people. So I'm going to read you a few poems that come out of that. I can really make sense out of it in retrospect. At the time, I just felt desperate. I thought, I've got to get these poems written, and I'm not very good, and I'll just do what I can to get something decent. And I realized that I was doing something very valuable. I realized later I had done something that was valuable for me. At the time, it didn't feel so great. This first poem wanted to get started because I was listening to some jazz one night in Kansas City, where I lived for a while, which used to be a big jazz place. It was pretty bad jazz. It was a pretty bad bar, and I was drinking a pretty bad drink. And still, I got overtaken by a kind of false nostalgia for an era that hadn't been mine, that was sort of a jazz era, kind of decadent, smoky, tired out. And some sort of I started thinking of images that I wanted to use, and eventually I could make them cohere by choosing a persona who was sort of a jaded woman of some sort. This is called bravado. I should have been one of those lean women seen up and down the coast with neat gin. A long story. By mistake, I live miles from water and do not smoke. This man on the saxophone moans and plans his journey someplace else. His cheeks swell as though pushed down through sea air and old money. He doesn't understand. There is no war anywhere, no veranda, no bravado of sons about to leave. That I am a woman with no ear for an old story. That my cheek sags when touched, that there are no more bad nights, that another year has fattened and passed without smudging my unastonished eye. This next poem got started, this must have been after I'd been married a fairly short time, and I was getting a sense of the creatureliness of living with someone else. And at one point, this is very vague in my memory, so I'm not going to even try to make too much sense of it, but I got interested in the fact that, in a new realization that we are indeed, and I wanted to do something with mammalian imagery. And I wrote a poem that ended up being kind of a didactic poem that was sort of too deliberately dealing with these images, and I had to put it away for a while. And one night I had been jogging, and I was sitting on the hood of my car just looking around and, you know, congratulating myself that I'd managed to do it one more time. And it was dusk, and I saw some kids walking home from a bus stop. And I suddenly had a flash of remembering how it felt to be a child at dusk when the lights are just starting to go on and you're just starting and you're about to go home to a lighted place, but you're still in this outdoor, mysteriously changing atmosphere. And I suddenly had a flash of remembering how I felt as a child and how much like an animal I felt, just with that sensibility. And I don't know how long it took me to realize that that was what I wanted for the poem, but I ended up recasting all the images from the point of view of a small boy, which I've never been. That's one nice way of vicarious experience. But I think came from realizing that I wanted a child's point of view, and I guess I wanted a little boy because I thought of him maybe as more wild and more connected with his animal self, although I don't actually believe that there should be a difference. This is not written in the voice of a little boy. It's written more from the point of view. It's called Fur. The small boy at dusk arranges himself in the dark bones of a tree. Moths enter the blue air and come home. His mother leans into it, calling his name. Her body smells like milk. Behind her, the moon climbs like a slow howl, and his father comes home, swollen or in pain, resting on the last few stairs. His voice breaks into the small room. Listening, the boy finds no place for so many words, and later his mother's kiss adheres to him like fur. He kicks off the sheets and hears nothing. Two eyes touch the length of him through branches. A long way in, he hears his parents breathe through their skin. Long vowels uncurl in their throats. He hears his name as less than sound, a slight movement of wings. This is also is a voice poem that isn't in a voice, but more out of another point of view. And this one really baffles me because I don't quite remember how I got started with it, but this one's called Midwife. And it deals with a subject that I have no first-hand knowledge about. And not only do I not know much except what I've seen in movies, you know, hyper melodramatic births where, you know, the woman is some kind of hero and there's all sorts of screaming and sweating going on, and I don't really believe in it that much. But somehow in this poem, not only did I find myself talking from the point of view of someone who has access to birth, but I also found myself reversing what I thought would be the role between the midwife, the professional, and the woman giving birth, who might not be so cool about it. It really kind of turned around on me as I worked on the poem. I think that happens when you get in another point of view, and it's one of the reasons why I really like it, that it ends up leading me around more than me leading it. And I needed to learn how to do that very badly in the beginning, and that was, for me, the best thing to teach me. Midwife. She smells blood in her hair and dreams of crouching at the limits of her skin. Having spent themselves, the new mothers sleep like men in the scent of what they are. The pain is the first scream to dismantle itself. They did not try to swallow her hands, small, awed husbands. Each speaks softly on two legs, as if the room had been lit by candles. It is she who reels in the corridor. They smell of flowers. They say it was only the body emptying itself. Actually, there's another kind of experience I've never had. And I must have gotten interested in it by watching The Nun Story on TV at a time in my life when nothing much was happening in my life except teaching four sections of sophomore composition. My first teaching job, it was a pretty bleak year. I wrote a lot of poems that year for me anyway. Now that my life's getting to be more fun, I'm having trouble getting those poems finished. But I guess my taste for vicarious experience really got going that year, and I tried to write a poem, and this is another one I had to put away for a while. I tried to write a poem from the point of view of someone who had started out wanting to be a nun. It's long enough ago, so I can't give you a real coherent story about why I was interested in it or how I solved the problem. I do know that I had to put the poem away for a year. And this is another voice poem, and again, it's something, I guess I'm fascinated by. There's something very beautiful and also very terrifying about the notion of secluding yourself that way, and I guess I must have been thinking about it subconsciously a lot, and that all backed this poem. This is called Shade. You never saw your mother's body, only a face which fades now without disappearing, like the saints' faces in silver. Nuns, the sisters you might have kept, they knelt and rose as though made of air. Where did their legs begin? They gathered their skirts like girls, and you took no food without their blessing. Now you must think before rising. I went to him without thinking. I touched him everywhere. Within the folds of their skirts, the nuns rose as though wearing nothing. They rose as though leaving their bodies. Already the sun grows, and you rise, porous with sleep and sweating. He makes room as you pass. You remember how the leaves in midsummer clouded the stained glass, and the litanies, the murmuring of their voices, like insects moving into the shade. Another poem that this one wanted to be a voice poem, and it really ended up, I think this was the beginning of my getting out of meeting other voices. This poem started out from a free association assignment that I gave to a class, one of my classes, and somebody brought in a little wire statue of a figure that looked like it was either kicking a football or dancing, and we all wrote about it for 15 minutes, and I decided it was a dancer, And I decided to use it as an excuse to work out some images from a point of view I've always wanted to have, which is that of a dancer. I've always thought it'd be wonderful to be a dancer, that somehow to be able to be on stage and move like that for a little while every day would be sort of save my soul. I've always envied people who do that. And so I thought I was going to be working out a kind of celebration, and I ended up finding, like with the midwife, I found some reversals taking place. I think I'll read this one twice. I won't say anything more about it. Dancing. At dawn, I begin at the window, unable to begin in the flesh-colored light. At night, I am singular and white in my multiple names. I can turn each of my bones to air. I can take the trembling when it begins, deep inside, like a gypsy swallowing flame. I've heard that men are frightened of my body, that they conjure it in the dark over women they've made into wives. My last lover never closed his eyes. Magnificent, he said carefully, as though I were water and he a swan poised over a swan's image. Lately now, the bed tilts while I sleep. By morning, I'm stiff, endangered like some parchments. The child I may never have rises, plump with sleep. My thoughts lurch backward, straining for purchase, resume their necessary flow. For a long time while I worked on that poem, I thought I was writing about a persona. I was picturing a dancer who is not too old to dance beautifully, but is beginning to feel old and is beginning to feel a kind of terror and a kind of fatigue. And it's not something I think about a lot, so I was kind of intrigued with what was happening. But I also realized as I worked on this poem that I was also writing very personally, and I think maybe, at least I've found with voice poems, I don't know if this has happened to some of you or not, I find that I am really writing myself back into some part of myself that is as much part of me as it is about another character. It's just that I'm going in through the back door. And in this poem, I really understood kind of quickly that I was also writing about process. And it's the process of writing. There's that fatigue, there's that sense, can I still do it? A sense that I almost can't. And so at that point, I changed the title to Dancing, because I wanted it to have more to do with the process than a person. I'll read this one more time. Dancing. At dawn, I begin at the window, unable to begin in the flesh-colored light. At night, I am singular and white in my multiple names. I can turn each of my bones to air. I can take the trembling when it begins deep inside, like a gypsy swallowing flame. I've heard that men are frightened of my body, that they conjure it in the dark over women they've made into wives. My last lover never closed his eyes. Magnificent, he said carefully, as though water, and he a swan poised over a swan's image. Lately now, the bed tilts while I sleep. By morning, I'm stiff, endangered like some parchments. The child I may never have rises, plump with sleep. My thoughts lurch backward, straining for purchase, resume their necessary flow. I want to try something next that I've only done once before, and I'm hoping it'll work because you're all writers, and that is simply to read you a journal entry that I did that led to a poem. Because I'm always intrigued with talk to other writers, the relationship between the beginnings of a poem and what they end up with. I don't want to gross anybody out. what started this poem was hearing about a conversation between two men. And I wasn't there when the conversation took place, but I was told about it. And I was kind of amused when I heard about it, because I've always been kind of interested in the way men talk about women. And I'm not angry. I mean, I just think of it as a phenomenon. I don't you know, I may not like some of the things that go on, but I certainly don't think there's anything wrong with it. I'm just interested in the dynamic. I'm interested in the way men look at women. And when I heard, I found myself wondering about this conversation. Well, you know, what was really going on between the lines of that conversation? Were they really just talking about what they thought they were talking about? I don't know how much I need to say about this. I'll read you the journal entry and hope that that is one cohesive entity, and then I'll just turn around and read you the poem, which was certainly a fictional adaptation of what I started out. The journal entry, I think it was a kind of speculative rampage. I started out saying what I had heard about the conversation, and then I started asking myself a bunch of questions about the conversation, and from there I went on to write a poem. So this is the journal. Stephen said that Hal said to him, sometimes he goes home and, quote, fucks his wife's brains out. Hal is one of the few men I know who says he is happy. Curiously, he is not stupid. He is a good-natured intellectual, teaches history, illuminates for college students the qualities of our culture that give rise to wars. He finds the Nazis horrifying and also a source of humor. He loves Sichuan food. He, quote, fucks her brains out. As a woman, I try to picture this way of keeping depression at bay. He fucks her brains out. His penis becomes a drill, a grenade. Going out later for a beer, does he still look at strange women with longing? Does he talk with a colleague about famous military campaigns? Does he compliment the colleague on his sexy wife? Does the colleague take this as a personal compliment? Are parts of a woman's body code to save men from using words like happiness and longing? He fucks her brains out. Then his penis sleeps like a small animal. He mentions happiness, and we gather around him like tourists with cameras at the scene of a hit-and-run accident. Already this entry started off, you know, started to go into fantasy. I asked a lot of questions. I began to think, just now it occurred to me that maybe a lot of my poems result from my having asked myself questions, either on paper or just walking around. And I guess I wanted to continue asking them. So that's where the Sunday dialogues came from, if any of you read this poem in the book. And in the poem, I really can't explain it too well because I got myself thoroughly confused. It's an eight-part poem, which means that each little part is a little island. It's supposed to be taken as itself. But the situation in the poem is a woman, I think, a woman sitting in a bar overhearing two men talking. Kind of blurring in the poem between the dialogue between the men and the dialogue between the woman and the men, which is taking place probably in the woman's mind. They're not literally having any interaction at all. Probably an interaction of sensibility. I remember getting wonderfully confused as I worked on this poem as to just what was going on, and I decided that was all right. So I will read you this, and I'll read you the numbers so you'll know when one part's over and another one begins. Sunday dialogue. One. Two men. One drains his glass. One eyes a placid woman crossing unremarkable legs. One says he only imagines his hands on the thighs of women half asleep who slowly feel his damp skin. One says, I tear off their clothes. Two. The woman I have become crosses her legs and stares at newsprint page, a strand of hair, her glass suddenly empty. He tears off their clothes. I cross my legs. Three. He would tear off her clothes. She stares out the window as if waiting to breathe. His hips would move fast as a boy's. She hears him explain an idea has walls and floors below ground. His hips would move faster than she remembers later. Four. One says young girls imagine themselves more real than their mothers, who retire calmly at night in flannel gowns. Five. The other surrounds her as though each of his limbs were a body. Six. Or does he brush each of her fingers gently, 7. Surely she moves and forces him to dance. Does he wave his arms and say, "Darling"? Do his hands close and open against his will? Who removes the water and the broken glass? At the next table, a woman crosses and recrosses her legs. A stone on a chain hangs between the waitress's breasts. A single stone, warm as a finger, sinks and rises as she hands him a glass. I feel like reading you more cohesive poems suddenly. I guess this hasn't happened very often, but it's a kind of a neat thing I want to keep in mind. Some of the things I've written, or some of the things that have most impressed me emotionally, have come out of friendships and have come out of very close interactions, intense talking, but also just an emotional openness to another person that comes out of a certain kind of friendship. And I have one friend, probably the first person I ever had this kind of friendship with, who at one point I realized when she was telling me about herself, I'd really be internalizing a sense of what it felt like to be her. It was kind of a neat feeling. I guess it's like reading or seeing a movie, but it's more intense because there's a certain amount of affection involved and therefore more empathy. She told me about an image that she saw, and it happened when she was driving through Europe with her husband and small child, and she was very, very tired, and she was driving past a park where a group of hydrocephalic children were being taken for a walk, and they were all in a big group, and they had a nurse or a keeper, and they were dressed very formally, and it just seemed very odd to her, but she saw it just driving and went on driving. And the way she described the image was just made it very vivid, and she also mentioned the frame of mind she was in, which was a kind of extreme fatigue and depression, the kind of thing you can get when you're traveling too long and are taking care of people at the same time. I don't remember any more of the context of the image, but it did haunt her, and she told me how it haunted her, and I guess I must have taken it home, and it wanted to be in a poem. It wanted to have a poem built around it. So I made it into a situation. I gave it a beginning and I gave it an end. I wrote a sort of narrative poem, but I was really getting into her point of view in order to write it. And when I showed her the poem later, it turned out that a lot of the things I had made up were pretty much true, literally true, as well as emotionally true. And it just seemed like a wonderful kind of transference in which the self gets out of the way, which I think is a very good thing for the self to do in this writing, and where I really did link up with her feeling and with looking at things through her eyes. So it was a nice experience for me, kind of a liberating thing. This is called "In Barcelona You Tried to Scream." You had spent the day looking at paintings. The real park was too green, still dappled at twilight. The crippled children sat too quietly. Someone had dressed them in lace and gabardine, like the antique figures you'd seen through a haze of fatigue. You covered your daughter's eyes. You stared at the children under the trees, who stared at nothing, their incurable lives. Their death seemed to rise inside them like the sleep of the newly born. Their nurse gazed over the pond. Your husband said, "Just drive." And you held the wheel like a pair of shoulders. Tonight you dine in Paris. Without turning, you know the street outside glitters, that people speak cheerfully into the wind. If you close your eyes, you can see the women's faces floating like orchids. Your husband offers you a light, and you lean forward in your fragile chair in the middle of Paris. In an invisible France, people you'll never meet are lighting lamps for their frightened children, or driving too fast, or selling everything. In Barcelona, you tried to scream. In Paris, your husband offers you a light, and his hands carve themselves in one motion behind your eyes. This next poem is more about an experience that really happened. And one of the things that was funny about it is that I wished it wasn't happening as it was happening, which it had to do with overhearing somebody moaning in an apartment across the way from mine, and I couldn't tell if she was in ecstasy or being killed. And I realized at that point that vicarious experience is great as long as it's in your imagination. It's a little bit uncomfortable when you start having to deal with it more directly, but I wrote about it anyway. This is called Last Night They Heard the Woman Upstairs. Last night they heard the woman upstairs moaning. They lay in bed, and she did not stop, and she did not stop, and she did not grow louder. The husband saw her once, moon-faced and ample on the stairs. The wife did not move her hand along his thigh, short hairs springing there. For a moment, she pictured him not in the bed, not alive, and a scream cracking like some withered thing from her lips. Tonight, the husband is reading. The wife bites into a peach. The woman upstairs slams a door. The building takes back its silence like breath. Last night, they heard her moaning, and they waited, and they thought their skin was visible through the sheets and the drawn shade. And the husband said, she must make love slowly, the way she climbs the stairs. Another thing that I've felt comfortable with for a long time, I don't know how to talk about recent poems, but at least while I'm in this book, I can give you some writerly tidbits. I know that in many cases it helps me to feel that I'm telling a story. It's always the task for me is always taking images, which are my way of translating feelings, and then trying to find a way to organize them. And it's usually either picking a voice or stumbling across a voice or letting one evolve, or finding some kind of chronology or deliberate destruction of chronology. In other words, using the narrative trajectory in some way for organizing the images. And very often, just a simple telling of a story and sketching of a scene has been a good way out for me. And this next poem makes use of that. Also, while I was working on it, I found a quote that seemed to express the emotion that I was trying to make concrete. So I stuck it in as an epigram, and that is, she felt free, but there was nothing she could do about it. That's from a Peter Handke story about his mother called Sorrow Beyond Dreams. It's a wonderful story, and I stole half the title. I just kept the Beyond Dreams part. She calls on herself. She loosens her hair before the woman in the mirror who smiles as the man would smile at such long hair. She picks up a shell that seems to pull the walls of the room toward itself, like a woman carrying a child. She touches it, as she might touch every part of the man's body. At dusk, she eats as though someone else is eating, as though the man has poured the wine, and she has brought them into a safe hunger. And when the man arrives, looking for someone slender, someone smelling of petals, someone whose hands might follow the curve of his great sadness, he finds strands of long hair in the brush, long dresses in the closet, himself in the mirror with a young girl who keeps rising to touch books and small objects, who keeps looking out the window as if someone were waiting. I'm going to move over to some new poems now. I feel these are strange to me still to read, even though some of them aren't that new, because I think they are in various ways I'm trying to deal more directly with my own feelings or go backwards and fish things out that really are mine and that I'm conscious of as being mine. And I don't know if that's what happens when you get older or when you get self-indulgent. I don't know what it means, except that I think it's good to take risks. And I think I guess I was very afraid to risk being sentimental because, like you, I was very highly trained by a lot of workshops, and there were certain things I just felt were real no-nos. And I think these are the things I'm trying to, as far I can, I'm just trying to see how, to what degree I can let them into my poems without self-destructing. To various degrees, you'll see this in these poems. I don't know. Now that I've said all that, maybe you should just forget it and listen to the poem. I can't be too articulate about the recent past. This poem was an attempt to do something that I've enjoyed giving out as an assignment, which is to take an experience that you've had as a child. I'm going along the theory that children are very perceive very strongly and lodge things in their memories and are very cognizant of certain things that are going on around them before they can talk, before they can really understand language completely, and before they can use language. Nevertheless, they're functioning and they're storing memories, and or maybe they're even thinking in language, but they're not using it. I don't know. But what happens when you have things you want to express and you're too small to do it? I decided to ask my students, and I also asked myself, try to put words or try to find images that will read something that maybe you were never able to talk about when it happened. And this poem is about a phenomenon that I was never able to explain to my parents. It had to do with being afraid of the dark, but there was nothing I could name. There was no monster, no dream, there's nothing about the dark itself that really frightened me, but it had something to do with the fact that when the room was dark, I could still see pictures in front of my eyes. Somebody had told me if I wanted not to be bored in the dark, I'd learned that I could make myself see pictures. And wasn't that nice? I would be able to see something. I wouldn't have to lie there in the dark being bored and feeling deserted. But I learned that once I got the pictures going, I couldn't make them go away. And so I'd yell for my father, but I didn't know what to say to him. I must have been able to talk. I must have been able to understand language. But I never could tell him why I was so terrified, because it simply had to do with something in my own head that seemed to be a visual phenomenon. And once I evoked it, I couldn't make it stop. It was like having to hear music that won't go away. And now I'm not sure if that's accurate. And I don't even know if the poem deals with that very directly, but that's what started the poem. I decided I wanted to try to re-evoke the situation, which meant making things up. The father in this poem is a lot more articulate and poetic than my father, who's an engineer, was. he helped me a lot, but he didn't fail these things about the dark. So I took a lot of poetic license here. This is called Private Act. My father promised as he shut my room dark. Night was the sun's eye blinking. I promised I wouldn't chew paper again or leave the damp wads like amulets under the bed. I shut my eyes. The guests raised their drinks and told stories downstairs, laughing in their bracelets, their rings of smoke. Their strange breath bloomed with attention. I opened my eyes, but the paisley sofa print rose still, a copper wave that filled and kept filling my eyes' black room. I crept to the stairs where light floated up, and sometimes a string of words I would wear for the night. He tucked me in again. He promised me dark as a pair of arms, rocking water, a blanket my size. The paper tasted salty, the taste of my first lie. Then I crept among scented furs on the bed no one made my parents sleep in. No, I slept all night in the bed where I belonged. While turquoise threads branched like bits of sky through my mother's watercolored gown, and morning came slow, gray through every window at once. I've lived in El Paso for 3 years, and from the very beginning I was struck by the Southwest, because it has a kind of drama, physical drama, especially sunsets, that it's just so overwhelming. I've really gotten involved in it, and I have never really wanted to write about it, although I have thought about it a lot, but suddenly this fall I found myself wanting to deal with the landscape, and it's really hard to write description. you know, you feel like you're writing a greeting card or something. So you try to describe something that's blatantly beautiful and everybody knows about and sees pictures of. And I hope I'm going to try more of this, because what was interesting is I had to find, well, I guess you always do. If you're going to talk about something, you have to find another thing that you're going to talk about at the same time. And somehow by just juxtaposing those things, you can add depth to the thing you thought you wanted to talk about. You can also trick yourself into talking about something else. I think that's helped me a lot. I'm not sure about that, but I'll just hand it out as a possibility. And that certainly helped me, because you can't just write description. Any fiction writer knows you can't just write description. You have to break it up. This is called Rain in the Desert. It leaves this city suddenly porous, all windows thrown open. Whatever grows out there in the sand closes in now, breathing like the gray horse that once detached himself at dusk from the dark end of a pasture. I'd thought he was a shed or a pile of birch. And I want to laugh again, having been right this time all day, as my temples closed over grievance, fat around the heart, then flared. I wanted sudden stones across old water, a vein of pure logic, someone to grab my hand. Now the sun offers the last of itself, a bruised light, horizon has pulled the sky apart, and the beaten streets, dark rivers, shine as though through tears. Now the houses have disappeared, leaving their windows full of lamps, leaving these low hills resting under lamps. One thing that was happening when I wrote that, I often find that after I'm through with a poem, or at least through with one writing of it, I have a very large physical picture of the whole situation. The whole room has been furnished, even though I'm only writing about what's happening on the sofa, that kind of thing. And I know that while writing this poem, I just kept retasting the sense of how, well, sometimes sunsets and sometimes with weather in the desert, at least in El Paso, there's a lot of mountain ranges to look at all the time, that when the weather changes there, you often feel that you're in two times of day at once. It can be night over here, and you can still see sun over there. Raining over here, and you can see clear weather over there. And I just had never seen that before. So I really had the sense of dual time. And I don't know if that's in the poem or not, but it's something I'll never forget, because I had to live with that. I did live with that vision for a while. It's a nice way of doing intimacy, I guess, to a place. I'm going to read this poem that was on the little reading sheet, one called Flash Flood. One of the things I wanted to mention about it, there's an image at the end about a child staring from his mother's lap, and I got that image from the photograph of Tranströmer in Ironwood. We were talking about that earlier. There's this wonderful picture of Tranströmer and his wife and first child, and they just are looking directly out at the audience, at the camera. And that child just looks so sure of himself. He just looks like he can handle anything. She. This poem started out with an attempt to write about feelings that cluster around how when you're grown up, you still have this feeling that you really haven't come very far, that your parents still have a sort of awful hold on you, even though it only comes up in subtle situations. It's the kind of vulnerability that an adult feels, I think, when their child self comes out. And while I was working on the poem, I was also teaching Tranströmer, and I was using that issue of Ironwood for my class, and I just found myself looking at that picture again and again and thinking, this kid looks like they'll never have this problem. And so that kid came into the poem. I wouldn't say this, so I'm assuming that most of you have seen the poem before, so I'm not ruining it by saying where that image came from, because in a way it doesn't matter. I also did for this poem, I spliced two things. I made up phone conversations that never took place verbatim, but there is a mood to the phone conversation that is autobiographical. And there's also the fact that one night when I was living in Kansas City, we had a terrible flood that made national news. And it was happening two blocks from my house, and I didn't realize what was happening down there until people started calling me up long distance and saying, are you all right? you know, you're killed all over the place where you live. And I was really shocked that I had been so unaware. All I could hear was the rain, deafening rain. So I spliced the two things together. I ended up splicing them together. I thought I was going to try to do a lot more ambitious things, but I had to give up. Flash flood. My parents called to say, "Are you all right? You shouldn't be alone. We can't sleep." Again, I tell them I live on a hill. I tell them it's only rain, beating like robbers at the window. They tell me, "We've never liked you living alone. When are you coming home?" And now I remember all the beaux who borrowed money, the bath I once left running, the ceiling cracking under where I should have been, the tantrums, the anniversaries, the notes of thanks. And now the president rises from a public meal where food lies on his plate like an abandoned village, prodded and intact. I rise to fix a sandwich. I walk softly for the neighbors downstairs, while somewhere at sea, in a wallet warmed by some sailor's hip, a child stares boldly in his mother's lap, as though the camera were an eye just opening the world to him. I think I'll read you a fairly long poem, in the sense that it's in three sections, each of which is about as long as some of the poems I've been reading. This was really a case that helped me learn how to superimpose different things on each other in order to deal with something. It started out as a poem trying to use a lot of imagery that had to do with being divorced. And I got some interesting images, but finally, that's one of those subjects, it's like writing about love or autumn, to write about divorce. It's pretty hard to do it with any kind of originality. It's hard to do it without being self-indulgent. There's a certain kind of, a lot of distance you have to get. And I didn't know what to do with the images for a long time. But I ended up finding two things help. For one thing, I ended up wanting to use a lot of images that have to do with reading The Moviegoer, which is probably my favorite novel. And it's probably made a big impression on me in ways I can't describe at the moment. But you're going to hear in the poem some references to that novel. It's by Walker Percy. It takes place in Louisiana. In the middle section of the poem, there's an italicized section which simply refers to the book. And that's why I just want to explain what's going on. If you were reading the poem, you would see the italics and you'd get the message that the voice is changing. Another thing that helped me was to cast this poem in the point of view of someone who's jogging. Because there's something about the circular flow of thought that gets going when you run. You think about something, your mind wanders, it comes back, it wanders. And I found that that movement was really what I needed. And that accommodated the divorce imagery, and it accommodated the moviegoer, and it accommodated a narrative line. And it also, I wasn't conscious of all this while I was working on it. This poem got dismantled many, many times. But it was a nice arrival, finally. It ended up being in three parts, and ended up having a lot of italics in it, and being rather complex. But I think I've kind of tied all the strands for you enough. This is called Running. One. Lately, my neighbor wheezes, pounding dough. Her forearms glazed with sweat and flour. At your age, my mother writes, I wanted babies. I got pregnant each time one of you learned to walk. I circle the block again and again until I run outside my body. This time last year, my husband's stalking of the other woman who slept poorly inside him. She promised in another town to give him up. All night she tossed and tried to speak until he spoke of his father, who drank himself into the cracked well of his voice and never touched bottom. She made him wake sweating and brooding in the close room of his departure, while I ran myself past my neighbor's lawn and loaves, plump and settling in their heat, to an early shape of myself. Two. I've forgotten whose apartment stretched like a tunnel shapeless and dark, the way my good dress hung too large, a formal body outside my body. The other men drifted alike behind their drink, while he stood in one place and spoke to me of the moviegoer, which spoke, he said, to his very soul. Sometimes I run in Louisiana, where I've never been, where the hero saw an egret gather itself over swamp mist and settle in a single oak that rose to meet it. Later he married his cousin, whose agile mind wandered, glittering at the family table. The dense mahogany. The black butler wheezed as he passed buttered beans. She couldn't sleep, she said, without pills. Sometimes she slept for 2 days. She promised she could be like anyone if he would tell her each morning how to pass that day. That night, my skin held me like liquid glass. I wanted to slip my hand beneath his elbow, to dance, to see the other women naked inside their clothes. 3. Every morning I run through pollen, late summer haze or rain. My husband is an illness I had in another country. The day he left, again and again he said, none of it was my fault. I circle the block, pump and sweat until I run outside my body. My ribs ached. He ran his hands gently over them. Inside my running, I write to him, breaking the silence we keep for his new wife. I saw the sun disappear into mist as it reached the horizon. I saw an egret airborne, circling all this time. The morning bus gathers husband and children and leaves from a soft rope of exhaust. I draw breath over breath as the children must breathe in their sleep. My neighbor waves from her doorway, watches my easy stride. Your waist, she says wistfully, fits the dress I wore as a bride. 4. It's kind of bitchy. I think it's a persona poem. I sure hope it's a persona poem. It sounds like Dorothy Parker wrote it. It's fun to read because it's in dialogue, and for me it was a made-up situation, although it's probably going to come back to haunt me when I become salty old dame. This is called Loyalty. Our eyes meet over other couples' shoulders, and another love saunters its vows. His body lifts in my direction, but not, I assure myself, without grace. I offer my ringless hand. Shall we dance? On his waist, my hand meets the roll of flesh, the wife who let her body go. I remind myself there's no such thing as a badly made man. Your eyes, he says, and my glasses slipped into their silk purse. His chin settles into my neck. The pearls, I say, were a gift from the man I didn't marry. Tall, dark, and riddled with beauty, he spent my ardor to please, pressing any knees under glass tables. This one breathes in my ear with a two-step. I rise to my toes to follow on air. Oh, I learned to calm on that phone, while a stranger breathed hard words of love. Now my life is about to change. He tells me his mistress, all legs and caramel skin, just left for the coast. We dance, we drink, we doze on each other's shoulders. We stare at stars, which stay in their dark, and gather ourselves towards morning, the rough ride out of our clothes. I hope I'm going to write a lot of dancing poems. I'm really still kind of fascinated with that whole thing. I have another one to read you, which is written way after the first one, but I have a sense that it's a vein that I want to keep following. And this one is quite direct also. The American Deaf Dance Company came to El Paso last fall. And in addition to being moved by the beautiful dancing, which I would have been in any event, I think one of the things I think about dancers when I watch them perform is the sense they must be transformed by what they're doing out there. That how can they just get off the stage with those beautiful, perfect bodies and be ordinary? You know, do they drink Coke? Do they eat French fries? I can't imagine it. They just look so... They're almost mythologizing themselves on stage. And maybe that's one of the things I just admire so much about it. And I kind of like that illusion. When I was watching the American Deaf Dance Company, there was no music. It was just movement. And I found that fantasy held up better because in a way, when they were finished dancing, they wouldn't go off stage and start gossiping or giggling or making silly noises, that they would still somehow be left in that world that they had created, which is probably not true. I mean, you know, when you watch them do their signing, that's another kind of dancing, and it's a very articulate thing. But I kept the fantasy that what they were doing on stage, they would keep close to them longer because that in a way they were protected from mundane life. And it was that impression that made me write this poem. I really don't think I'm giving the poem away by saying it. But I enjoyed my fantasy so much, I just thought I'd hand it out. This is called The American Deaf Dance Company, Whistle Stop. The middle section is in italics. I guess I want you to think of that as flashback. I don't know how to read flashbacks yet. They mark stress as a sting of landing. Swift kiss, another leap apart. I lean in my seat, missing you. My knees crack. Our old dispute loosens its whims. The words curled on themselves. And the trip to a movie etched for good. Some couples smoked hurriedly, locking their cars. Later, we held the plot like ice in our mouths, walked home, melting it down, while streetlights sent us ahead. Why did we never walk barefoot through that house? Bleached denim sweeps their thighs, their breath the only other sound. Their eyes never leave the space they weave as they leave the ground. And I clap my hands high so they'll see. She falls again into his sure arms. This next poem, I find myself when I teach writing, telling people not to try to write too directly about things that consume them emotionally, because it's usually, you know, pretty bad way to begin writing a poem. I've always advocated for myself and for students finding an area where you are ignorant and fascinated, and then just going in there and exploring and using your writing as a method of exploration. Sounds wonderful, and it does work. But this poem wanted very much to be about something. It was probably the first time I ever allowed myself to use an emotion and just keep working and working and working at it until I got something out of it. And it came from the experience of having a close friend of mine call me at 5 in the morning one morning and saying, "Would you mind coming over? I've been raped and I think I need some help," which was very calm, but the message was just like a bombshell, you know, like the ringing of the telephone itself. And as it turned out, she wasn't damaged unduly by any of it beyond the event itself, and she was treated well by the police and she was treated well by the hospitals, and everything came out reasonably all right. But there were shockwaves from just the whole experience of knowing someone and of being awakened into that so suddenly. And afterwards, I found that for the first time in my life, I was afraid, as though it had happened to me. I was suddenly seeing the world through the same sense of vulnerability, as though I had had that happen. And up until then, it had never come to home. I was indignant about it as a phenomenon, but I had never been hurt by it. And I still haven't been directly hurt by it. But after this happened to a friend, it was something that became part of my emotional makeup for a while. It was also during a period where I was very aware of the flip side, that there's great tenderness and there's great violence between men and women. And in addition to reacting to the rape, I also just found myself thinking about that dual nature. So I tried dealing with all those things in this poem. And I think the main effort I had writing it, I called it The Rapist, and I've always advocated understatement, so to have anything with a working title of The Rapist, I felt constantly that I was breaking my own rules. And I found that most of the work I had to do was cutting, finally, when I had everything down that I thought I needed. I had to just slash and slash and slash, because the temptation, of course, is to get melodramatic. So I ended up with four short sections, each of which is separated by an asterisk, so I really need a pause to be a little stronger than a stanza break. The second one is in italics, because I mean it flashback. The Rapist. You do not know how long he sat by the bed, moving the hidden parts of your body to another mattress in his head. You never saw his face. Later, police found bits of the kitchen window tracked with damp soil through every room. Your first lover was a large man, soft from years of longing for extraordinary women, and had small hands. His skin burned easily in the sun. That first night, pleased and desperate, he licked parts of your body you'd never seen, then shuddered, settled, and drifted in your arms. You were too pleased to sleep. You arranged yourself over your sore parts. All night, his eyes moved under soft blue lids, as though seeking the other woman he'd leave asleep. Awake, you would ease him into daylight. The doctor found hairs inside your body. He found them with tweezers and a pinpoint of light. The police, he said, will keep them for evidence. You keep telling yourself he was not a large man. In each hot bath, his body loosens from yours like paint. Night after night, your breath are weightless in the water. Neither plants nor animals are laced with stubborn blue veins. All night, your eyes move under dark lids, as though seeking a familiar woman inside yourself. I want to try a couple of poems on you, and this is always risky. There are two that I'm in doubt about. The first one is fun. It won't be taxing. In fact, what's wrong with it might just be that it's too easy. So, I hope you enjoy it, but I also would welcome suggestions. You're all trained in criticism, and I could use it if you have it. I also feel that reading poems that aren't finished isn't necessarily an imposition on people. They vanish right away. But both of these poems I'm sort of trying out on you, speculatively. And this first one just might be too neat, but it's fun to read. It's called Domestic Wine. My friends are quitting smoking, being quoted on the news, fumbling for ice 2 a.m., watching every foreign film. Each plans to leave town soon. Each is the hero of a story that begins, "I've never told this to anyone." My friends at dawn in their running shoes. My friends after dark in their good skin and turquoise. My friends who will never marry again. My friends for whom I open late at night into an eye that listens. Their rings catch the light. Their cheekbones and brows surface like carvings over tables they've stripped and waxed again. Even the air takes shape between their hands as each, like a bandit, plots the perfect departure. My friends who sleep pretending themselves held by someone they've never met. My friends saying, "My children." My friends falling warily in love over glasses of wine. One by one, they tell me, "Finally, I know myself." stumbled there because of the last minute I switched lines around. I've been doing first aid on these all day so I can try to read them. This next one may still be notes. I don't know. There's a lot of images that I've been trying to organize that have to do with what it feels like to move away. And I started out with a very minimal poem, and I expanded it, and now I'm trying to cut it back down. And fairly recently, I decided to divide it into short sections. So I just want to hear what it sounds like. I don't know if this is the form it's going to take, and I want to keep a kind of fragmentary feeling to it, but I might be too fragmentary still. Moving. Every night, these walls seem to twitch once and settle as the body gives into sleep. Painting leans from its nail. And every morning you rub the strange stiffness from your eyes, the corners of your mouth. Soon the first cracks will surface like bits of rope where a child's boat rests underwater, letting go. 2. Every morning you wake out of breath. Soon you will leave, with water to last, another walk through a town grown blank with doors and sunlight slammed into glass. Keep breathing. Think of the eye as sealed, a bay fed by spring. 3. Every summer, people you've loved go back and get older, with or without you. At night, the surface, all glass over moon and deep ice, is as warm as your hand. All winter, no one is around. The reeds wave and wave underwater, its steady wind. 4. These windows, this seared roof, these yards that shrink every year in their sparse, discolored green. Soon you will wonder if you lived here at all. Every morning you wake out of breath. For a while, let your voice go wrong against the ribs, a slow root hugging the dark. I'm going to finish up with one poem out of Natural Histories that I just like. This poem started out with an image, you know, just a single image that I ended up growing a poem around. The image came from standing around in waiting to register my car in the state of Missouri one January day. It was altogether a depressing experience and a depressing day. And there was a long line, and the building that we were in was you know, lit by fluorescent lights, and people's boots were dribbling mud all over the place, and it was just icky. And the woman waiting on everyone was real busy and was dressed for action in a pantsuit, and she had short brown hair and was medium, some kind of indeterminate age, and she must have been wearing Oxfords. I didn't see her feet, but the whole image was that she probably was wearing Oxfords. And, you know, there's nothing attractive in the room. It was all set up for business and very routine business, and it was depressing. But she was wearing a pair of, they looked like antique cameo earrings. I wasn't standing all that close to her. But the earrings were the one decorative thing in the room, and they just struck me. So, and somehow this poem came out of that image. This is called Why There Are Children. Inside every woman lights the candle. This is the woman sons look for when they leave their wives. Daughters become wives thinking they travel backwards to the dresser covered with lace, the hairpins still scattered there, and the cameo earrings. The same gnarled tree darkens the bedroom window. The hair coiled in a locket conceals the hands of men and children. When a woman shivers on the porch, perhaps at dusk, it is the other wanting a shawl. When a woman in her middle years rises and dresses for work, the other reaches for the cameos, remembering a great love and herself on the brink of it. Thank you very much.